Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Moses Lapin, and today I'm joined by Professor Stephen J. Zipperstein to discuss his new book, Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History, published by Live Right W.W. Norton in 2018. Professor Zipperstein is the Daniel E. Koshland Professor in Jewish Culture and History at Stanford University. Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History is a work that challenges its readers to think differently, to explore the consequences of a single event just 3 days long, not only for its actors, both victims and perpetrators, but its legacy as well. Memorialized by poets and authors, documented in painstaking detail by journalists, demographers, and historians, accurately or not, Kishinev came to be symbolic of Jewish life in the Russian Empire, a symbol that would have great effect over the course of the 20th century. In bringing together materials found in archives across the world in many languages to complement popular accounts of the event, Professor Zipperstein gives us a new lens with which to see the pogrom and its consequences more clearly. In today's interview, we will discover new types of radical politics and anti-Semitism, the until now mysterious origins of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and the ways in which our memories of events are shaped to different, often competing, ends. How did the lives of a small Jewish community come to mean so much? I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Zipperstein. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Let's begin with the context in which the book features and in the context of the Kishinev pogrom. And that's the sort of first section of the book. Can you give us a sense of the city of Kishinev and what Jewish life was like in general in this period?
The city itself, actually, by the at the moment that the pogrom breaks out in the spring of 1903, is one of the largest cities in the Russian Empire. But though large, it's not all that much is known about it. It's rather remote. It's in a far southwest corner of the empire. An area with rather poor roads and rather awful rail transport. The Russian government, it seems, doesn't improve access to the area because of fear of Romanian invasion. The border of Romania is just a few dozen miles to the west of the capital city of Bessarabia, the area that Kishinev is located in and is a provincial capital. So on the one hand, it's a very large city and it's grown very quickly in the few decades before the pogrom. And it's an area that is both extremely poor, but has exceptionally rich land. And a Jewish community that's fairly new to the area. Jews have been living in this region for hundreds of years, but the Jewish community of Kishinev and the other cities in the region have grown dramatically in the decades before the pogrom. And it's an area known for its agricultural goods, for its hides, for its wine, fairly cheap wine, most of which is exported to Odessa and other nearby ports. Odessa is about 100 miles to the east, and very much dominates the region's commercial life. And in many ways, it's Jewish religious life. It has a large community, and close to perhaps half of the population of Kishinev is Jewish. But it has many Jewish schools and institutions and a local yeshiva, but no rabbinic figures of stature beyond the immediate region. And that's true up until the 1920s and 30s. It's a city comparable, say, to Fresno, California in the 1950s and 60s, much more similar to Fresno than to, say, Sacramento or Los Angeles.
What is a pogrom? And can you describe the events of the pogrom of 1903 as they unfolded?
Well, the term itself, the actual origins of the term pogrom aren't really known. The term itself derives from Russian word for thunder or storm. And the term is used before Kishinev and afterwards to describe all sorts of attacks in Russia. In the wake of the Kishinev pogrom and then the wave of attacks during the constitutional crisis in Russia between 1905 and 1906, the term comes to be understood by Jews in a very particular way. It comes to be understood as a government condoned or coordinated attack against Jews. Technically, that is not correct, as I describe in my book, and as scholars before me have demonstrated before. The fact that it's believed by Jews, deeply believed by Jews and others, that the government coordinates such attacks, and that it coordinated the Kishinev pogrom, and in the case of Kishinev, that there was actual proof that the government coordinated the pogrom in the form of a document signed by the Minister of Interior, that has a great impact on Jews, on Jewish attitudes toward Russia, on Jewish attitudes toward conservatism, on the opening up of Jewish immigration to the United States at a time when the immigration of Chinese, for example, is profoundly restricted. And pogrom, as I see it, came to mean for Russian Jews the outer limits of the unbearable conditions of Jews in Russia. So even if you haven't personally experienced a pogrom, it's always possible that you might. Pogroms come to be seen as the ultimate proof of the unlivability of Romanov Russia, the need to either leave it or transform it radically.
Why is this pogrom such a point of fascination in history, both Jewish and general history, but particularly in the memory of modern Jews? What is it about it that stands out as different or as unique? It's certainly not the first outbreak of violence in Jewish history or even for Russian Jews. And perhaps most importantly, and this is a central theme that runs throughout your book, is the ways in which it engaged an international community. What was it about it that engaged, that held the attention of Jews and non-Jews outside of the pale?
Yeah, much of my book is devoted to the pogrom's imprint and the way in which, why it becomes what it eventually becomes for Jews and for others, as I try to demonstrate. The part of the reason has to do just with chance and contingency, the location of Kishinev, very close to the Romanian border, which is the most porous of all the borders in the Russian Empire, the easiest border to smuggle news out from. And probably for this reason, the Zionist movement establishes its so-called correspondence bureau in Kishinev, headed by a very enterprising activist, a doctor named Jacob Bernstein Kogan, who's established by 1903 very close connections with newspapers throughout the world. He's no longer at the helm of this bureau in 1903, but the connections exist. And because of the porousness of the border, because of the connections of Bernstein Kogan, news about the pogrom spreads with alacrity, And we know how that happens. We have access to telegrams received by newspapers around the world sent by Bernstein Kogan. And it's a moment where newspapers, and especially the very enterprising and rather sensationalist Hearst Press, the press owned by William Randolph Hearst, is keenly interested in Jews. Hearst is considering a run for the Democratic ticket for the governorship of New York. He's even considering a presidential run. He's courting Jews. Jews are now numerous in New York, and in particular in Chicago and elsewhere. And the Kishinev pogrom fascinates him from the outset. He devotes large sums of money for Jewish relief, and then sends this ace reporter, a well-known Irish revolutionary, Michael Davitt, to Kishinev to report on the aftermath of the pogrom. His articles are widely read. The book based on the articles becomes the first best-selling book in any Western language on the condition of Jews in Russia. And that book is devoted to the Kishinev pogrom. The pogrom, I think, also garners an enormous attention because it's the first significant attack against Jews in the new century, a new century that ostensibly will be a more benign century than the previous one. And so its impact is all the greater. Newspapers are beginning to use photographs, and the Kishinev pogrom is the first anti-Jewish event of its kind with pictorial evidence. And I think another reason, oddly enough, has to do with a relatively small number of Jews who were killed in the Kishinev pogrom. It's a very violent attack, as I describe it in my book. But you're right, by no means the largest attack against Jews in that region. Pogroms are by no means as prevalent in the region as Jews have tended to recall in the past. The previous wave is between 1881 in 1882, with no Jews killed during those attacks. But in Kishinev, the 45 Jews who were killed, another four die of wounds incurred during the pogrom shortly afterwards. The 45 Jews who were killed can all be lined up in a photograph. You could see all of them. And in some ways, that creates a kind of pictorial power that is in its way far greater than, say, the killing of 500 or 600 Jews on the streets in Odessa in fall of 1905. And so I think that, and the final reason I'd mention is that the pogrom occurs during a period of unusual coherence for a full range of Jewish political movements, Zionists, Jewish socialists, and others. They're at their height just at that moment. And despite all of their differences, all agree that the Kishinev pogrom is an event of absolutely shattering importance. And so, and then all integrate the event into their institutional history. Zionism eventually comes to see the Kishinev pogrom as the precursor to the creation of the Haganah and the Israeli army. And we could talk about this later if you like, the pogrom has a comparable impact, astonishingly enough, on a full array of other figures and institutions, including some of the most influential anti-Semitic endeavors of the 20th century.
Over the course of the interview, I hope we come back to unpack your answer and the number of themes that you raised. Something there that you spoke at the end of your last answer was about sort of the stakes of the Kishinev pogrom, or the legacy, the stakes of the legacy of the pogrom. So I was wondering if you can reflect a little bit on this. What was at stake? And I think in your book, one of the things that's exciting about it, and particularly in with regard to an event that's so well known and has so much literature written about it, you analyze or take into consideration both things that are accurate and inaccurate representations of the events. And your book is by no means limited to looking for causes or things like that. So again, what were the stakes of this representation or of the reception of the pogrom? What I mean by the stakes there is at the end of your last answer, and later on in your book, when you talk about the relationship between the pogrom and the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you talk about how the event was seen both as a Jewish powerlessness, as victims, but also as an example of Jewish power and some sort of mysterious cabal or some way in which Jews can influence public opinion or world events. And that's one example of the ways in which the pogrom had large stakes, the ways in which people perceived Jews. But it seems to be that the pogrom was used by many people internationally over a long period of time for certain purposes. Your book ends with the ways in which the pogrom is related to the establishment of the NAACP.
Yeah, when you say used, much of what occurs is done for the most, out of sincerity. Of course, people can both be sincere and hideous. Those who are responsible for writing the first version of what becomes the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, its original title is somewhat different, write it as is generally agreed upon by students of the first version. And I use their work and then go beyond it because of a new material that I discovered about its first publisher and its likely first author or co-author, author Pavel Klushevan, one of the most famous anti-Semites in late imperial Russia. Those who produce the protocols are, as I see it, sincere in their beliefs, as hideous as their beliefs are. What came to interest me a great deal about the about all that tumbled from the Kishinev pogrom is the creation of a very thick mythology that in turn has a history of its own. And so even if there is not a direct relationship, and as I see it, there is often not a direct relationship between the actual facts of the pogrom and how the pogrom ends up being seen through various eyes, some eyes sympathetic to Jews, others not, those beliefs end up shaping history. And all of us share beliefs that might perhaps be empirically disproven, but that nonetheless define who we are and how we see the world. In the wake of the pogrom, for example, the impact of Chaim Nachman Bialik's brilliant poem, Bir HaRegan, The City of Killing, where he puts at the very horrific epicenter of the pogrom a section that describes the shameful behavior of Jewish men, of husbands, of brothers, of fathers who cower with terror as their wives, their mothers, their sisters are being raped. What I've come to conclude based on a variety of archival sources, as described in the book, is that such incidents do occur, and Bialik is basing himself on testimony that he collects. He spends some 5 weeks in Kishinev after the pogrom, speaking with dozens and dozens of witnesses and survivors. What Bialik excludes, perhaps astonishingly, from the poem, but includes in his copious notes based on his conversations, are all of the acts of Jewish self-defense, both organized and sporadic, that occur. These find no echo at all in the poem, which is all the more surprising since the arguments made in the many, many dozens of trials of pogromists, there were some 900 arrested, and the trials of clusters of pogromists continued well up through December 1903. In their trials, as often as not, their defense attorneys argue that the violence, the fact that this the attack resulted in extreme violence was all a byproduct of Jewish aggression, that Jews attacked Gentiles on the second day of the pogrom, the fiercest day of the pogrom, with such ferocity that the Gentiles were simply acting in self-defense. And so, oddly enough, the non-Jewish narratives highlighted Jewish aggression, and the best known, the most canonic of all Jewish narratives highlighted the Jewish passivity, and the both have had an impact on subsequent, sometimes very influential institutions and bodies of literature.
Let's take up the book itself. It's made up of six chapters, which are sort of, in one sense, independent essays, and in the other sense, together build up your perspective of the pogrom and the way in which it was received. What would you say are some of the themes that undergird the different essays and bring them together and really hold together your perspective in the book?
The book is structured in such a way where the very first chapter makes a case as to the pervasiveness of the term pogrom as an explanatory term that basically encapsulates how so many Jews and others have come to see the Russian Jewish past and perhaps the Jewish past as a whole. I problematize that notion, and the part of the book's intent to make a case that that those who minimize for political reasons or other reasons the Jewish disaster in the last century are simply wrong to do so, but Jews who tend to see recent Jewish history as simply a history of disaster are themselves wrong, and it seemed to me a useful way of wrestling with both assumptions was to actually take the totemic event before the Holocaust, the Kishinev pogrom, the event that defined for 20th century Jews before the Second World War, the outer limits of anti-Jewish violence, and to try to understand it, both the event itself and its aftermath. So the first chapter wrestles with those themes. The second chapter looks closely at the city of Kishinev itself, the region of Bessarabia that it's located in, and the relationships between Jews and non-Jews in the region. The third chapter is a very detailed portrait of the pogrom itself. The pogrom, as I argue in the book, is probably the best known event or the best documented event in Russian Jewish life at the time. And so one can actually move almost quarter hour by quarter hour and see what it is that occurs on the streets of Kishinev during the day and a half that the pogrom is at its height. I argue that there is a fascinating interplay between this wealth of documentation and the density of mythology that the Kishinev pogrom produces. The fourth chapter focuses on the two most influential works on the Kishinev pogrom, Bialik's poem in the City of Killing, and the book by Michael David on the Kishinev pogrom. And I was able to use Michael David's notes, the notes he took for the book. They're located in Trinity College, Dublin, and draw on them to look closely at how he saw the pogrom, much of what he excised from the book, and how he was able to construct his narrative. The fifth chapter is devoted to arguably the single most influential work to have been shaped by the pogrom, a work vastly different, of course, from Bialik's poem, and that's the first version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I benefited in the construction of this chapter from a previously unknown archival source in private hands. It was in the hands of a Moldovan Jewish journalist, the private papers of Khrushchevan, the publisher and likely the first author or co-author of the first version. And these were papers that Khrushchevan had given to a nephew of his most beloved relative, and probably a cache of papers that included the most sensitive documents that Khrushchevan had in his possession. And I could speak about why these were so sensitive a bit later on. And the last chapter, perhaps in some ways the most surprising of all, though the chapter on Khrushchevan certainly surprised me too as I was writing it, is a chapter devoted to the imprint of the Kishinev pogrom and subsequent pogroms on the American left, on Jews in the left, and those beyond the Jewish left. And what I came to understand was that the explosion of attention in the United States, in particular, surrounding the pogrom, created a conversation that had been rather sporadic before the Kishinev pogrom and the pogroms of 1905, 1906, about the lack of attention given in the United States, even on the left, to lynching, and the a direct connection between lynching and pogroms was actually first formulated publicly and prominently by a now largely forgotten turn-of-the-century Jewish radical, Anna Strunsky, as it happens, a graduate of my university, Stanford, and she had co-authored a book with Jack London. She was a prominent radical. She ended up traveling in Russia for some 2 years with her with a man who became her husband, William Walling, who wrote most widely read book about Russian radicals before John Reed's 10 Days That Shook the World, a book published just after their trip to Russia, their stay in Russia between 1906 and 1908. And it was on the stage of Cooper Union in speaking about the book that Anna Strunsky actually made a direct connection between American lynching and pogroms. And immediately after that meeting, discussion started in earnest, finally culminating with the creation of what became the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in Anna Strunsky's and William Walling's apartment in New York City. Walling becomes the first chair or co-chair of the NAACP. And if you will, the promiscuous impacts of Kishinev and ended up fascinating me, and the way it created so much knowledge, some based on misperception but at the same time, knowledge that has become part of the intellectual baggage of so many in the 20th century and later.
You describe the book as a microhistory and as an international history. What are these two historical methods, and how did they shape your writing of the book?
That was hard. And it was hard to do because I also wanted it to be a book that was a work of subtlety. The story I'm telling is, I think, a subtle one, but I wanted to write it in such a way where it spoke beyond the world of historians and people in Jewish studies. And so I worked very hard at trying to make it as accessible as possible without losing any of its intellectual density. And this is a close study of one particular place and events that occur in the place. And at the same time, the events that occur in the place often radically transmuted end up shaping the consciousness of Jews and so many others, and help Jews understand the contour of Russian Jewish life, an immensely complex contour, end up, as I see it, serving to flatten the sense that so many Jews come to have of the lives of Russian Jews. Those streets, especially the streets where the worst of the violence occurs during the Kishinev pogrom, on the second day of the pogrom, lasting from about 11 a.m. on the second day to around 3:30 or 4, those streets, really six or seven streets, really no more than alleyways, and I've seen the streets subsequently during a trip to Moldova, end up being, as I see it, the best known streets in Russian Jewish life. And to what can be really extrapolated from those experiences, to what extent these streets are typical of the lives of the millions of Jews who lived in Russia, serious questions could be raised about that. So mine is a book that takes violence against Jews very seriously and then raises questions, in some instances troubling questions, about what it is that we as Jews and that others have done with that history. And, you know, among the questions that research on the book raised for me, I'm someone who sees the world through a left liberal prism, are questions about the depth of my own distrust of political conservatism, a distrust which deepened by the belief that results from the Kishinev pogrom, that arch-conservative governments like those of Imperial Russia actually plan attacks against Jews like that of Kishinev, where people go beat and kill and rape Jews. And that belief, at least in the case of Kishinev, was based on a forgery. A forgery, the so-called Pleve letter that ostensibly was signed by the Minister of Interior, who hated Jews, as did most Russian officials at the time, but did not foment attacks on the streets of the cities of the Russian Empire. And so I finished the book, I admit, with a greater degree of modesty with regard to my own assumptions about the interplay between rationality and belief in my own belief system. And it's for this reason that I actually begin the book with the quote of the art historian Abby Warburg, that where the very first words of the book are And let me get this right in turn, where she says God is in the details. And as an historian, that's where I look for causality. That's where I look for meaning. And at the same time, I've come to realize that for me, no less than for others who might define their deepest assumptions on the basis of religious belief, there are deeply felt beliefs that shape my own worldview that probably can't be shaken, and at the same time are based on, in some instances, historically questionable assumptions.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and I think it is something that the book contributes not only as a work of history, but in thinking about the contemporary relevance of history, not just of the event necessarily, but of a type of thinking. The book itself is made up of this sort of international perspective. As you mentioned, you found this archive in Ireland, and it's certainly Russia and America and across Europe. So I was wondering if you can reflect a little bit for us the process of writing and researching the book. What was it like? How did you bring together all these various archival sources, as well as the other types of sources you use? You use literary sources, as you mentioned by the poem Chaim Nachman Bialik, but also journalistic sources. So what was the process of researching the book like, and how did it come together for you?
With difficulty. I wasn't sure at first how it would come together, and I worked a great deal on the book's rhythm, if you will, and in some instances, some of the more important insights were the result of discoveries made rather late in the book's writing. My discovery of this archival cache of Khrushchev's papers, where I found that Khrushchev, who today is seen as one of the most influential pioneers of what's called in the southern regions, at least of the former Soviet Union, Christian socialism, which combines a antagonism toward capitalism, a embrace of integral nationalism, anti-Semitism, homophobia. I found that Khrushchev, among the papers that I discovered, was an adolescent diary of his, where he speaks very vividly of his a sexual relationship he's then involved in with a Cossack, a declaration that he wishes he was born a lady, and a host of other revelations that were probably much of the reason why he handed this material to a very trusted and beloved relative when he was dying of cancer. He died at the age of 49. Also, I mean, a great surprise to me, because Khrushchev was seen in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom, and for various reasons, by Jews in Russia and elsewhere, as one of the most powerful anti-Semites in the world at the time. Khrushchev was in such debt that his furniture is assessed by a series of bailiffs. I know the kind of wood that his desk was made of, his bookshelves are made of. I know I have a list of all of his furniture in his Petersburg apartment. He moves from Kishinev to Petersburg soon before the pogrom. And also, it turns out, and I only have one source for this, but a rather substantial source, his mother dies very young, and he's deeply affected by this and mourns her throughout his life. His stepmother is, it seems, a Jew. I imagine a Jew who converted. He's raised in Siroki, which is 60% Jewish, a town filled with Yiddish signs in front of stores. And this I didn't discover in the archive, but I discovered separately. His sister, his stepsister, the daughter of his stepmother, runs off with a Jew to the United States. And there are pictures of her in a Russian language American newspaper in the 1930s with her hair covered. She's an Orthodox Jew living in Baltimore. And for a while, her husband worked as a shamus in a synagogue in New York. You know, this you can't make up. I realized when I discovered this that had I been writing a novel and delivered this to a fiction editor at my press, I published the book with Norton, they would say, no, this is impossible. This isn't how life is. And yet here it is. To some extent, the structure of the book resulted from these surprising finds. On another level, I knew from the outset that the pogrom exerted an influence that often cut across the standard lines of Jewish and non-Jewish history, of Russian history and Russian Jewish history. These lines really a byproduct of the fall of Imperial Russia, the creation of the Soviet Union, the end of any kind of coherent Jewish historical writing in the Soviet Union. And what I was attempting to do as someone who could read across the various relevant languages is to try to create a history as close to the way in which it was lived at the time as is possible. What I did with this book, as I've done with previous books, and is to simply swim in as much of the material as possible, subdivide it as sensibly as I knew how, and then allow the form to emerge out of this mass of data. And I lived with it for a while until I felt I had something more than formlessness.
How would you say the pogrom still features either in general history or maybe more interestingly in Jewish memory today? On one hand, there's so much material about it, but part of what you uncover in your book is not just the facts, but the ways in which it became, as you mentioned, totemic of a number of different ideas, some of them competing. So in the contemporary setting, what role do you think Kishinev and the pogrom of 1913 plays in people's minds and memory?
Yeah, 1903. I think it's obvious. One of the more obvious examples are the various speeches of Benjamin Netanyahu, and who refers to the Kishinev pogrom at the at a memorial for the Toulouse massacre, the massacre of French Jewish children. Refers to it in memorial service in 2012. He references the pogrom, or at least one of Bialik's poems about the pogrom, after the killing of the three yeshiva teenagers in the West Bank that precipitates the last Gaza war. Part of this has to do with, I suppose, the existence of Bialik's Kishinev poetry in the school curriculum that Netanyahu might have experienced as a child. I can't recall whether he was raised in the United States or in Israel, but he would have had access to it. But and his he cherry picks from Bialik's poetry. He rarely recites lines that speak about the insidiousness of vengeance. But I think the notion embedded in Bialik's poetry that one of the worst traits of the Jewish past was the absence of aggression, and consequently, at least as Netanyahu would read it, one of the crucial facets of the contemporary Jewish consciousness is aggression, I think is a prime example of the way in which the poem ends up remaining front and center in the consciousness of very influential Jews today. And the fact that the protocols really remains the one truly resonant anti-Semitic work of all the huge, huge body of anti-Semitica produced in modernity is, I think, a vivid example of the way in which the pogrom continues to resonate. It resonates profoundly in the consciousness of the Russian right, or even in a figure who draws from this arsenal and who isn't necessarily a part of the Russian right, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his late life book on Jews and Russians. He devotes nearly an entire chapter to the Kishinev pogrom, and he argues in that chapter that the Kishinev pogrom's most insidious impact is its impact on Russians, not Jews. And he argues that the worldwide condemnation of Russia in the wake of the pogrom, the widespread belief that the Russian government was responsible, weakened the allegiance of Russian liberals toward the Romanov regime in Russia, weakened the commitment of governments elsewhere. And he draws a direct line from the Kishinev pogrom to the Bolshevik Revolution. And so in non-Jewish circles and circles inimical to Jews and circles that speak for Jews, the Kishinev pogrom remains alive. I think probably its greatest, if less palpably obvious, impact is in the way in which it and the residue it leaves created an impression of the events of Kishinev as Jewish normalcy. This is what Jewish life was like. With enormous frequency, and I've collected these obituaries over the years, obituaries in the New York Times of Jews born in the Russian Empire, almost invariably, when a Jew who's come to the United States from the Russian Empire, from pre-1917 Russia, dies, the reason why this person or his or her family has come to the United States is credited to pogroms, that they're escaping pogroms. And with great frequency, the people in the obituary come from regions where there were no pogroms. The conflation of the Jewish past with pogrom is so pervasive. And it seems to me that was not created alone, but consolidated inordinately by the Kishinev pogrom.
Thank you so much for coming on to the program. It was wonderful to get a chance to talk to you about your book, which I certainly found fascinating as I was reading it, and I'm sure many of the listeners will. We've been here today with Professor Stephen J. Zipperstein on the Jewish Studies channel of the New Books Network, talking about his new book, Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History, published by Liverlight Norton Press in 2018.